the inability to attach, to reach the property is about $300,000 remaining.
$300,000?
$300,000.
Okay. Representative, thank you. Representative Hugo?
Well, then the meat of the building is at line 13, as I see it in section 3, where we're allowing you to attach all property and property rights. And then on page 2, lines 14 and 15, what you're saying is once that attachment is made, that I can't transfer the property to avoid the lien. Is that essentially what the bill says?
Representative Hugo, that is exactly what it says.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Steve?
Yes.
Representative Skoon?
Why shouldn't we make this determination to further the courts rather than the department?
Make it how, sir?
Why shouldn't we require that the courts determine that the trust is, as a matter of fact, sheltering the taxes of the individual rather than leaving that up to the department?
Representative Skoon, excuse me, Dick, I think that they actually do that. It starts out through the appeal process at the department with the deficiency stage, but it's based on those federal laws that Dick referred to. And those grantor trust requirements or situations are in the code. So it starts out as an income tax a deficiency, basically, the income tax or inheritance, gift, et cetera, tax. And then goes through the deficiency stage and the assessment stage. And at the tax court level, they would, in fact, be determining that it was a grantor trust. So, in fact, that the courts already do determine whether it is a grantor trust, but it is through the appeal process of the department.
Good, sir.
Question.
Section 2 allows for adjudication of the issue, and then Section 3 allows the department to take action through a lien on property if the final ordinance warrants that. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Skoon.
Final determination, though, under Section 2 can mean an assessment by the Director of the Department of Revenue or an order of the Director of the Department of Revenue. I think that your point was that for the trust to be termed a grantor trust, it must have already gone through some adjudication. Is that really true? I don't know if it's true or not.
It's under the normal appeal process. The auditor determines that this is a grantor trust. And that usually isn't very difficult to determine. Generally, there's pretty clear powers of revocation or termination of the trust, and other areas that are outlined in Section 671 to 678 of the Code are present. Anyhow, the auditor makes that determination. Now, if the grantor, who's the taxpayer that's being billed, doesn't appeal it, doesn't challenge that determination, then that becomes a final determination. If he does, and it goes to conference, and it's ruled against him, ruled in favor of the state, and the taxpayer grantor takes it no further, then that's a final determination. If he chooses to proceed with his appeal process and go to hearing, and an opinion or order comes out ruling against him, and he chooses not to take it on to court, then the opinion and order becomes the final determination. Or he can take it to court, in which case, if he loses, that becomes a final determination, unless he appeals to the Supreme Court. So final determination is all the way along the line under the normal appeal process.
Okay. Are there any more questions or comments? I think we're going to close the hearing on House Bill 2164. Thank you, Bill.
Appreciate it.
Yes.
Can you take an overview on this for just a moment for the benefit of the class?
Sure.
What you saw here was, as you mentioned in the bus coming down here, you have the administrative function here appealing to the legislation for authority to do a given thing, to execute a certain thing. You saw them, the representatives here, asking for information to make an intelligent decision on this. You also represented
Skoon,
excuse me.
Sorry.
Skoon investigated the legal aspect of it, courts, to go through the courts. Remember we discussed that? We had the courts, we had the administration, we had the legislative body working on it, on the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Tell us your name.
Dick Foster, I'm from Project Business. One of the business persons coming in. We teach classes one day a week in the local grade school.
Great. That's great. We're really pleased you took the time to do that. I think if we're all informed, we have better voters. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2164. We'll open the hearing on House Bill Senate.
Work session.
We're going to have a work session?
Yeah.
Okay.
Those have had a hearing.
The chair is the last time. Okay. Work session on Senate Bill 181, 182, and 189. We'll start with Senate Bill 181.
The department prepared some amendments for Senate Bill 189. When you had the hearing on it, there was some discussion.
Steve, we're doing 181 or 189.
Which one?
181. Did I say 189? I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. 181. There was some discussion about the penalty amount that the department could impose for on a taxpayer who repeatedly gives them a bad check. And those amendments are ready, I believe.
Bruce, you want to go on papers? Is it Landon or
Loudon?
Loudon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bruce Loudon from the Department of Revenue. Bruce, for the sake of the students, could you briefly, well, maybe we've heard enough, because Steve did explain it. I just want to make sure the students know what we're here about to do.
So did we.
We're waiting for our tea leaves, you know.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Loudon from the Oregon Department of Revenue. And in the last hearing that we conducted on this bill, Representative Schoon had indicated that he would like to have the penalty that we are asking for in this bill changed. In the bill, we would be asking for a penalty against repeat offenders who issue the Department of Revenue a non-sufficient fund check. And the tolerance that was built in there is that the penalty which we would assess would be three times the amount of the check, or a minimum of $100 with a maximum of $500. So you would have a tolerance of that any penalty assessed would be between $100 and $500. Representative Schoon had asked that we reduce that tolerance for if we had a situation where a person had written a small check down to $25. So we have prepared the amendments to reduce that to $25 at the request of Representative Schoon.
Representative Schoon.
This could apply to somebody that owes a very, very small amount, and on the second time the check bounced, which is not impossible for the small person who is having problems, $100 just seemed like a pretty big amount, and $25 does seem to be more reasonable. If this were only for corporate accounts over a certain size, I'd say $100 would be okay, but it can't apply to the individual who owes a very small amount, too. So I think that 25 is a minimum, is better. It is also the greater of $25 or three times the amount of the check, draft, or order, up to $500. And so I think there's plenty of room in there for plenty of punishment for somebody that's doing this.
Do I hear you moving the amendment?
So moved.
I've heard the motion.
Okay. You place the amendment.
He just did, sort of, yes. Representative Schoon has moved the amendment as prepared by Bruce Loudon of the Department of Revenue. Do I enter in discussion?
No, Chair. I'll support the amendment. However, what we're talking about here, in addition to the person who inadvertently makes a bad check, we're also looking at someone in the 920 who has a check that's dishonored because the maker of the check has no account, or in 921 because the maker of the check has ordered to stop payment of the check. And both those 920C is fraud, and 21 is a conscious action to stop payment on the thing. So I'm still going to support the amendment for the reasons that Representative Schoon mentioned. I'm just pointing out that if someone makes a check out to me and does not have an account, that we're not talking about a mathematical error in the checkbook. or if someone makes out a check to me and then subsequently stops order, stop payment order on it, that person is also attempting to defraud. But anyway, I agree with the general theme of the amendment and will support it.
You make a good point. Do I have any objections to the amendment? So ordered. That I might be clear, if we cannot pass a bill out, we can only move it to the full committee.
Yes.
And that's where the bill, the motion should be made.
Yes. Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 181 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Is there an objection? Senate Bill 181 will go to the full revenue committee.
So ordered.
We will open the hearing on Senate Bill 182.
Okay, there, 182, there was a question raised about in Section 2 dealing with legislative authority and delegating to the Department of Revenue. And there was a request that Elizabeth Stockdale review the language in the bill, and we have a copy of a letter from her to Representative Hanlon, and then also some possible amendments for you to consider. Those have to be distributed.
I've got one.
That's the same one as my page. Dangerous. Same door.
Jim, it's good to see you again. What are you about to share with us?
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm Jim Brown. I'm the administrator of the Collection Division of the Department of Revenue. At the last subcommittee work session on Senate Bill 182, there was, as Steve indicated, some concern over the delegation of the legislative authority in the area that Steve indicated in Section 2. And Elizabeth Stockdale of the Attorney General's Office has addressed this. I also talked to Barbara Senior of the Legislative Council Office, and she suggested the wording that Elizabeth has drafted in her proposed amendment to take, address the problem that was brought up by Representative Hamlin.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Just a comment. I read the March 8th letter. I got a copy early since it was addressed to me. And the third page is a copy of proposed amendments. In essence, it's Lawyer Stockdale's letter saying that there's no legal problem with the original wording, but if you want to correct it, here is the amendment. sounds like a lawyer.
Maybe I can explain that a little bit. What I did after the last work session is I contacted Elizabeth Stockdale, and she essentially told me what she said in the letter. Then I contacted Barbara Seymour, and Barbara wasn't as convinced as Elizabeth that there might not be a small problem there. So Barbara suggested the wording that's in the proposed amendments. So then I contacted Elizabeth back and said, and talked to her about that concern. So that was the reason it ended up.
Madam Chair, it would be my intent when we, when appropriate, to move the amendments.
Do we need to have any, well, I missed the hearing, so I'm probably the only one that needs some.
If I might, the basic question that I asked was in lines, in Section 2 of the Angross Bill, have we delegated too much authority to the Department of Revenue? And these amendments came back as a proposal for fixing our over-delegation.
Okay. You have all read the amendments and you have heard Representative Hanlon's motion. Do we have any questions?
Yeah, I guess it's funny.
You look quizzical, so I'm trying not to
I just, the thing that I find interesting is, as Representative Hanlon points out, the Department of Justice says that under case law we have the authority to do what the bill does. Then legislative council suggests that legislative council is not too sure and drafts amendments that go back to the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice then proposes amendments to something they say is okay in the first place. If everybody feels better with the amendments, then great, but I'm certainly not broke. No one, it never has been broke. But Representative Hanley has moved them, and that's fine.
Do I hear any objection? Do I hear a motion to send this to the full committee? Steve Meyer.
Before you take final action on that, there was a request that additional amendments be made to this bill by a couple of different legislators, and that would give some authority to the Department of Revenue to establish withholding from civil service and military retiree pension payments that cannot now be done. There are amendments drafted. There's copies available here if you would like to consider that at this time. It would be perhaps a good time to do it.
Tell me again where this came from.
I believe it was Representative Mason and
who was Senator Hamby and Representative Mason.
Can you talk to that, please?
Yes. Essentially, the thrust of the original bill was to bring Oregon withholding law in conformity with federal withholding law in three areas we've previously discussed. And since that last work session, we had some contact, as Steve indicated, with Senator Hamby and Representative Mason on a couple of other areas where withholding could be brought in more conformity with federal law, and they felt that those amendments or that those changes should be made. We did discuss them with Steve and your staff, and they thought that Senate Bill 182 might be an appropriate vehicle to get those changes in. Essentially, what the amendments do, the first page under Section 7, the federal government, through their United States Office of Personnel Management, has a program for voluntary state withholding on civil service pensions. And Oregon has not adopted that program and hasn't had the authority to adopt that program in the past. Essentially, what that does, under current federal law, if you're a retired federal civil servant, you have withholding on your pension, very similar to the withholding on you would have had on wages. Oregon, there would be no withholding, and you would be under the estimated tax program if you had a liability. What this provision does is it allows the retiree to make an election to have state withholding taken out of their civil service pension up front, rather than to go through the estimated tax program. And this is as a result of several civil service retirees request that be made available in Oregon. It is, I might point out, it is purely at the election of the retiree.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
So, the effect of these amendments would have no effect on the retiree if the retiree didn't want to have anything withheld.
That's correct, Representative Hanlon.
Thank you.
On the third page of the bill under Section 8, under the amendments, that this is essentially the same provision only with regard to retired military people. And again, they are in the same situation where they have currently federal withholding from their retirement pay, but no state withholding. And this, again, would be a voluntary arrangement where they could elect to have with state taxes withheld from those pensions at the time the payment's made, rather than be involved in the estimated tax program. And again, it's on a voluntary basis.
Representative Hugo, did you
review? I have a couple questions. First of all, an observation that on page 2, the word retirement has a peculiar spelling. On page 5 of the amendments, down toward the bottom, 2C, maximum amount to be withheld shall not exceed 10%, and
that would apply to the, to what? That would, that apply to both the military and other civil servant?
There is one other area that I haven't got to that, that maybe I can address now. On page 4, section 9, is takes in a third area where there is currently federal withholding on a voluntary basis and no state withholding, and that is on annuities or life insurance contracts, things like state of Oregon deferred compensation, individual retirement accounts, that type of a pension distribution. Under the federal law prior to 1983, the taxpayer had to elect to have withholding on those amounts. Otherwise, there was no withholding. Federal law was changed effective January 1, 1983 to be a reverse that said that there would be withholding unless they elected to not have federal withholding on those distributions. There hasn't been, and there hasn't been any authority for state withholding on those distributions. What we propose to do here is to provide for state withholding on those pension distributions on the same basis as federal. If they make an election to not have federal withholding, then that election would carry automatically over and there would be no state withholding unless they opted to have state withholding and no federal. So it's again, it's at an election basis and it ties us into the federal system.
My question was the actual amount is specified in section 9 at 10%, shall not exceed 10%. Is that consistent with federal or are you talking about a 10 is there?
Section.
If I wanted to elect to have withheld, how, let's go back to all the programs, three programs. We have federal, civil servant, we have military, and we have annuity payees. Okay. May I, and I can elect under any one of those things, to have state withholding under this proposal.
That's correct.
What rate of withholding is used? Is that determined by scale or is that
it's
by
determined, it's determined by the individual that's elected the withholding. How
so
much
I can specify whatever I want withheld.
Essentially what you would have, like on the military pension or civil service pension, it would be treated, you would file a W-4 for federal purposes, claiming a specific number of withholding allowances. And that would determine then where you would go on the withholding table and the amount of tax that would be withheld. And under Oregon law, that withholding allowance that you file for federal also controls how much Oregon withholding is taken out of your check unless you elect to file a separate document and have a separate amount of withholding for Oregon. So that provision would, that's in the normal wage withholding law would carry forward here.
Is there a limit on withholding on the federal retiree and the military as there is on the annuity? The limit here says that the amount shall not exceed 10% of the amount of money.
No, there's not. And I believe that the reason that this 10% is in there is that it, I believe it's under the non-periodic payments. And that's under our current administrative rule on unusual non-periodic payments, for example, a large bonus that a corporate officer may receive at the end of the year. The company has the election to use the normal withholding tables or withhold at a flat 10% rate. So this would address the situations where from a you received a lump sum distribution from one of these pensions, and then that option would be there to withhold up to 10%.
Any other questions, Representative
Hugo?
No, thank you.
Representative Hammond, do you have a question?
I do not. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Scoob.
I'll move the amendments, David 31385, for Senate Bill 182A.
You've heard the motion. Is there any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
With the adoption of these amendments we've just adopted, we've expanded the scope of this bill somewhat, put it mildly. I'd be willing to move the bill to the full committee with a strong recommendation that it be engrossed.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that.
Okay. So I suppose we could. That's not a formal motion. I would move Senate Bill 182 as extensively amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Procedurally, is the word extensively necessary to the motion?
I don't think so.
Should we take the roll or is it suffice to ask if there's any objection?
I don't think you need a roll.
I don't think so because it's not. Okay. Is there any objection? So ordered. Senate Bill 182 is going to the full committee. All right. Senate Bill 182.
Senate Bill 189 was held over. There are no amendments were requested to the bill. There was still a concern about one section of the bill. And let me get to that in a moment. I also have a note here from Senator Jane Cease with a letter that she wanted the committee members to be able to see, but it didn't get copied in time. A taxpayer has written several pages here about the bill and some of his concerns in the bill. I haven't had a chance to look at all of the concerns, but there are a few in here, and I guess I would just characterize the writer as a knowledgeable taxpayer from the way it's written. Again, concerned with the department's authority and potential abuses of that authority, I think. The concern of the committee the last time in the bill was dealing with, on page 3, subsection 9, in terms of whether the department does not hold a timely conference, and these provisions then would allow an extension, a 90-day extension for the department to go ahead and hold a conference and then pursue collection of the tax from that point. This was the Anaconda case reference, if you recall that, where the department lost their case against Anaconda because a conference was not held within the one-year period.
Now, sure, if we could ask Berlina to wander up here.
Yes, Berlina, would you come forward?
A couple of thoughts have occurred to me since we discussed this thing. One is, as I mentioned the other day, if the department drops the ball, you're asking that we help you pick up the ball again by enacting Section 9. In Section 5 of the bill, you go through all of the various time limits that the respondent has, and you have. I'm not too keen on Section 9, but I would be willing to expand the amount of time you have at the outset. Where would I find that in Section 5? Is it 120 days?
Representative Hugo, is that the one-year period that we have to have the conference? Is that the one you're referring?
I think you right now have a one-year period, and Section 9 is asking for another 90 days if you blow the year, right?
Right. Well, it's an extension on the limitation. That's correct.
Okay. Berlina, extension, is it on the taxes owed, or is it also on the penalty and the interest?
Madam Chair, the way this would work is if we do not give the conference within 1 year and then we assess in error, basically, what this would do is extend that limitation 90 more days where the taxpayer could then have a conference. At that time, though, the penalty and interest could not be collected. It would be voided. The only amount that could be collected and would still have to go through the appeal process would be the tax amount.
I guess we have to go up or down, don't we, eventually on it. I don't know.
Madam
Chair.
Yes, Representative.
The philosophical problem I have is we have the deadlines for reasons, and if the department can't if the department can't comply with the one-year period because of a lack of funding or a lack of support, legislative support, or Ways and Means support, then I think the argument should be made in the Ways and Means Committee. If the procedures and policies of the department are such that the 1 year is not sufficient, then change the 1 year. We have all kinds of dates that cause people anguish and wailing in the night, such as court filing dates that occasionally get missed, and when a date gets missed in court, the case is quite often just thrown out as not complying with the process. I'd much rather see you ask for an extension of 1 year than I just say that instead of a year it's going to be 18 months or something, as opposed to saying it's a year, but if we can't do it then we want it in the 90 days.
But if it's amended, it has to go back to the
You see what I'm saying?
Representative Hanlon, then I want to say something.
Well, I just want to agree with Representative Hugo and give a specific example in a claim where someone may be injured. There's a 2-year statute of limitations, regardless of the extent of the injury, regardless of the wealth or non-pecuniary wealth of whoever it is injured. And if the lawsuit is filed 2 years and 1 day after the accident, it's no good, regardless of whether the case is good.
Yeah. It would be the chair's request that we make copies of this letter, that we carry this over, have it first thing on the agenda, deal with it quickly, or whether it survives or dies, whatever, that the committee members have a copy of this,
okay,
give a copy to Verlina, and deal with it the first thing in the morning. Would that be all right?
Sure, yes.
I don't care where on the agenda, but as long as it's fresh in our mind. But it would give us an opportunity to read this. It would give Verlina an opportunity to respond to it. And I think we should tell Representative Senator Cease.
I just want to be sure it's said anything previously.
Okay. We're safe. Yes.
Well, I agree with Representative Hugo, but I've got some...